Okay, so welcome back again to another roundtable for the Religious Studies Project. My name is Ethan Quillen, as you probably know. Today we have a different group than we did last time in Chester, with some of the same people you recognize again. I'm going to pass off to Jonathan Tuckett, my co-convener for the roundtables. And so take it away, Jonathan.
Hello, my name's Jonathan Tuckett. You've probably heard me from some of the interviews by this point, and I am the resident phenomenologist. To my left is
Elizabeth Urzik. I am a visiting fellow from America here at New College, and my background is in ethnography.
Okay, I am Liam Sutherland. You may remember me from the first round table. I am a research master's here in Edinburgh looking at Tyler and Neo-Tylorianism.
Kevin Whiteside, Religious Studies Project Roundtable Regular.
I'm Kritika Bhattacharji. I'm a taught master student here, and my background's in history.
My name is Megan Gilliland, and I am studying New Testament textual criticism at University of Edinburgh. I am a second year PhD student.
Okay, so the question we're looking at today is whether religious studies should be multidisciplinary. For me, this is quite an important question. I've spent some time studying Ninian Smart, and he was a great fan of the idea that religious studies should be polymethodic, that we should incorporate a number of different fields into religious studies. I guess there are certain departments out there that do try and live up to that reputation, but I was wondering whether they do so successfully and whether we should be doing that in the first place. So, if there's any one of the other panel members who'd like to weigh in straight away, I'd like to open the floor to you.
Well, I feel that it largely already is multidisciplinary. I mean, maybe not as much as it could be, but actually, I mean, a lot of the theories we discuss, a lot of the thinkers we look at, a lot of the research we draw on is actually already comes out of anthropology, sociology, history, that religious studies is really more of a field with kind of disciplinary formations of its own. That's how I've always understood it.
So maybe the question I'd like to ask on that basis is, if it's already the case, is it a good thing that it is multidisciplinary?
Well, you know, one thing before we move into is it a good thing if it's multidisciplinary is that I would say for the most part, most of the professors in these departments, though, have been trained in one discipline. Mm-hmm. So the multidisciplinary actually comes hopefully from larger departments where you have more professors doing it. Mm. I think your question is really interesting in what does that mean for the people that are coming through these multidisciplinary programs now? What do they claim in terms of method expertise and things like that?
Okay, that's actually an interesting point because when I originally asked this question, I was thinking more of departments. We have departments that have, you know, the token anthropologist and the token sociologist, etc. But should individual scholars themselves be multidisciplinary in their approaches as they come into academia?
And let me ask you, how is the formation of the religious studies students here? Do they specialize in one methodology by the time they graduate?
It's certainly the case in Edinburgh that it used to be most scholars ended up being phenomenologists, mostly because Professor Cox taught phenomenology. Right now, I don't know there is a specific methodological focus. I mean, Liam or Kevin might be able to better answer that question than I am.
Well, there was certainly always an anthropological streak in Edinburgh, I think, mainly to Jan Openshaw and Elizabeth Coping. I think some of our lecturers tend towards sociology to an extent, but it's multidisciplinary, but not necessarily in one fixed methodology, I've always felt. I mean, even folk with a phenomenological streak have always drawn upon, you know, other disciplines as well.
Well, yes, but speaking as a phenomenologist, and maybe this is my own specific phenomenology, the implicit reason that I ask the question is because I am not a fan of being multidisciplinary. I think religious studies is actually faltering under the fact that it has so many methodologies upon which it draws from that it doesn't really have a good sense of self-identity. So if there's anybody out here who would like to, you know, deny my claims.
Is that important, that it has a strong sense of self-identity?
I think so in the current climate, yes. I think a strong sense of identity will help with things like funding.
So more for political reasons than the actual reasons of knowledge and that sort of...
Oh no, ideologically I think it shouldn't be multidisciplinary on the same grounds.
Jonathan, then weigh in. Which one would you pick?
I picked the ideological grounds, actually, I'll admit. I think we should have one methodology for religious studies, and everyone should adhere to that methodology.
But I think what Kevin sort of brought up is also a question of stake. What is at stake? So if you say, for example, that religious studies shouldn't be multidisciplinary, what are you also saying? And I mean, even with history, and again, my background's in history, it's not that there's one historical methodology. Historians draw from ethnography and anthropology in the same way as religious studies. People do. But I think because people are more likely to question the existence of a religious studies department much more than they are to question the existence of a history department, I get your point, that you, Jonathan's point, that is, that you might want to you might want to promote that idea of like an exclusive religious studies methodology. I don't agree, but I do get the concern.
I would like to hear a little more on how you would see that. No, honestly, because I would also agree. I've heard it said that disciplines come into being sometimes for a particular reason at a particular point in time, but they only seem to have legs and make its contribution to the larger academy if they actually offer a method, something that actually goes beyond its subject expertise to something that scholars in other disciplines can use, like a historical critical method or something like that. So I'm actually kind of going in your direction, Jonathan, that I just don't know what you would pick.
Well, as the phenomenologist, I would pick phenomenology as the methodology. I should put a stipulation to that. Many of the listeners will be thinking of the phenomenology of religion at this point. I mean something slightly more broader when I say phenomenology. I'm more philosophically inclined in that respect. I see phenomenology as potentially being the methodology for all social sciences at the end of the day, which is a pretty bold claim to make. But I'm interested to know why you think we should have a single methodology as well. Is there a particular experience that would lead you to that conclusion?
Well, I think I don't know that we can. I'm very intrigued that you have an idea of how it could be. That's why I'm going in that direction. But I do think that religious studies, one of the reasons why it is running a potential risk of being assumed into cultural studies or being recombined with history or other kinds of things, I mean, part of it can just be the pragmatics of what's happening in higher ed, but I think there's another piece of you almost have to prove your distinctiveness and singular voice separate from other voices, which sometimes is done through a methodological perspective. So the way most religious studies departments in America are, as I said, they're mostly professors that have been trained in singular disciplines that then have religion as the subject of which they're applying those disciplines in. I think we probably only had a few generations of scholars that have been trained within a religious studies department. I don't know if I'm making too big a claim here. But that becomes an issue. Most of the departments, everybody are so specialized that even to come up with a corpus of reading of what you have to know comprehensively is, I would say, even sometimes quite scattershot. You know, it's a few sociology books, a few psychology books, and so I think it's actually in the process of defining itself as a discipline. And the professors in the department necessarily don't have enough commonality between them to create that. As a matter of fact, I would say that probably your generation is the first time it's kind of fused into something.
Now, I'm wondering, does anybody in the room actually feel that they are a part of that self-identity? Could they define it at all?
Yes, I think so. Because I've just mainly trained in religious studies, even though I've taken up a lot of anthropology and sociology. And I think my position you might describe as a kind of middle position. Any theorist or methodology which looks at religion is of interest to us. But what we do need, I think, is a set of a roughly unified set of what we think we're doing with religious studies and a kind of a roughly agreed common ground. And I think that is that we are the meeting place for the social science of religion, I think we can take on history as well. I think really the social scientific approach to religion and even classic things like methodological agnosticism are very important. I think that, you know, a very loose humanistic science of religion is really what we should be attempting to be.
Even to the degree that you had a broad phenomenological overarching methodology, you'd still have an abundance of sub-methodologies, like it, depending on whether you wanted to do ethnography and field work or ethnologies or just philosophy, you'd still have each of those. No matter what, you still have to deal with the fact that people are trying to approach religion in different ways, and those different ways require different approaches to accessing whatever goal they have.
Certainly, but I guess should religious studies allow those other ways in a certain respect? I mean, we have the sociology of religion, which certainly comes at things from a very different angle, and we've already had this discussion previously in Chester, so I don't want to get into it too much, but maybe what I'm asking is, should religious studies stake its own claim a little more, and if by doing so kick out sociology, and not to pick on sociology, that seems a little unfair. The same would also go for anthropology.
Psychology of religion.
Certainly psychology of religion, which in a certain respects has an increased presence these days with the influence of the cognitive science approach.
Well, if you were to kick something out, what would you then say would be the only thing that should stay?
Religious
studies. I'm certain that Jonathan's going to say phenomenology, but if we were to kick out, and forgive me for jumping in on all this, but if we were going to kick out, let's say, sociology or anthropology and say, okay, well, religious studies means this, would you basically be ignoring the fact that religious studies started out of theology departments where we just wanted to study religion as a phenomenon, which is where phenomenology comes in, and then it has adapted all these other fields of methodology?
Oh, no,
according to religion.
I'm certainly not saying that we can't draw upon other disciplines. Like, as Liam was saying, that there are a whole history of theorists who have come up with some brilliant ideas that are all completely valid and useful for religious studies scholars. I'm talking very much so about the present context of taking ourselves away from the other departments and standing alone. I mean, there's nothing wrong in drawing upon other groups, but I mean, there has to. But when we draw upon it, we can't then just say, "Oh, we like the sociology of religion, sociology, and we'll use sociological stuff." We need to take it on as our own and mold it to our own purposes.
But why does that distinctness have to come from the methodology? I mean, the method is just one way of asserting distinctiveness and autonomy. It took history a long, long time to even begin a proper inquiry about methods of history, and even now, there's not all that much. I mean, there is some reflection, but I mean, you wouldn't find emphasis on methodology as strong in history as you would in say literary studies. But that hasn't in any way endangered the autonomy of history as a discipline or as a valid discipline. So I'm wondering why it should for religious studies.
Certainly, I mean, the methodological standpoint is very much so my particular position in the whole. Let's get religious studies defined and stood out there. I mean, you've got Russell McCutcheon, for example, went in the opposite direction to me in his book Critic or Caretakers, and he advocated that religious studies should be unified by its notions of theory. So, I mean, I'm perfectly happy to say that we could go with a completely different approach. I'm just saying that there needs to be a need for religious studies to be unified. It doesn't necessarily have to be done by the methodology. Megan, you look like you've got something to say.
I'm just trying, because I come from a slightly different field, I'm just trying to understand exactly where you're coming from. So from an outsider's point of view, what would unify you would be the fact that you're studying religions. And the methodology sort of seems to be sort of something that goes along with that, but it's not necessarily the most important defining factor. I mean, when I talk about biblical studies, you know, we have different approaches to it. So we have text criticism, we have literary criticism, you have a historical critical method, but those don't define us. You can have people studying biblical studies from linguistics point of view or sociology, but when they do that, the question is always asked, can you do both of them and do both of them really well? Because often that's very difficult to do.
Well, and I think that's partly the problem with trying to exorcise study of religion from anywhere but within religious studies, is that we don't understand sociology as well as the sociologists. We don't understand psychology as well as the psychologists. And so if they can put their lens onto the topic that we're interested in, they might be able to give us information that we can use in a way that we wouldn't have been able to gather. And then partly I think that's what's important about interdisciplinarity on top of multidisciplinarity, is we need people who can translate between the fields so that there's mutual understanding, as well as just individual scholars trying to take on multiple disciplines.
I was actually just thinking, there's an interesting thing about our specific school, the School of Divinity, because actually what religious studies stands out here is actually ironically more, I think we have more anthropological and sociological methods. Actually, we're probably, of all the disciplines in this particular school, biblical studies, theology, ecclesiastical history, we're roughly more a bit more ethnographic, and we're more connected to the social sciences. And I think that in this school, anyway, is what makes us stand out, you know.
Except for world Christian.
Oh, of course, that's
yes.
What we forgot about that.
Right, world Christianity as well.
Yeah. Well, I think I support Megan in that when people ask me about the longevity of religious studies, I think it's really defined mostly by its content area. And that's, but to your point, Jonathan, and also what you were saying, that I do think there is something about a larger theoretical contribution back to the larger discipline, to the larger academy, but it does seem pretty obvious that religious studies is organized mostly around its content area.
Well, kind of going back on what Kevin was just saying about how we don't understand psychology in the way that psychologists understand psychologists, could we not level the same claim back at them that they don't understand religion in the way that we understand religion?
Well, precisely, but that's why it's so interesting, because I think earlier you'd said that you think that phenomenology has a lot to offer all the social sciences. So in the same way as they can borrow from the methodology, one of the methodologies in religious studies, we can borrow as well. I mean, that's the point, I think. And also, if we, by virtue of the fact that we are studying religion, and that religion can lie, you know, it can lie in a painting, if you're studying, say, a painting, then you have to study it on its own terms. That's where visual culture theory, aesthetics, art, you can borrow from the methodologies they've used there, because you have to engage with what you're studying on its own terms, I think. And, yeah.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. We, in a great number of ways, we do know religion better than the other disciplines, and I think that's why it's important for departments for collaboration. If you have a psychologist and a religious studies scholar sit down together, and while the psychologist is working up his particular study, the religious studies scholar is saying, well, this factor doesn't work this well here because of this reason. And I mean, they work it out and they mutually benefit each other.
Definitely. So, essentially, a chorus sounds better than a solo.
And this could be my own ignorance of religious studies, but by defining religious studies by a methodology, at least here at this school, would that not hinder the development of religious studies as far as other methodologies that you could use as well? Would that keep you sort of backed up into a corner just by defining yourself by phenomenology?
I suppose to a certain extent I see what you mean, for instance, because you're more of a text critic in what you do. I mean, the phenomenological method that I am working on doesn't necessarily say this is how you look at a text and you do X, Y, and Z. I mean, it's a very general methodology for the study of phenomena, and phenomena are everything in any way. So it certainly comes back to your comment earlier that there will be subdivisions necessary within even the phenomenological method of how you go out into the field and study certain things, or how you read a text. But even then, is that necessarily multidisciplinary, that you have these subdivisions that you need to study texts, and you need to study people, and you need to study artworks and that you have specific rules for doing so, that doesn't necessarily mean, for me at least, that you then have to embrace the whole range of academic disciplines that are available.
Right. Jonathan, would you share this? I mean, what's coming down to is that you came in here with a certain vision of how to work, and we're all kind of grappling to try to be engaged with it. But why don't you just tell us how you see it could be? And then
how I see it could be. Well, part of it was that it's a very strong reaction to Ross McCutcheon, who said that religious studies should be about theories. But then throughout his work, I'm constantly wondering to myself, what methodology does he go on by these theories? Because it seems to me that he's accepting theories from psychology and sociology and anthropology, but each of these theories have been worked out on different methodologies. Mm-hmm. So when the sociologist disagrees with the psychologist, they're doing so on sociological grounds. So the psychologist isn't necessarily going to accept their refutation because they've used the wrong set of rules to refute the theory. So the whole reason for phenomenology, or the phenomenological method as being the underpinning for me, is that that way everybody has the same methodology, so that when somebody does put out a theory and someone else can refute and respond to it, and they can do so in the same framework.
Okay, provide a little more detail there.
Provide a little more detail to the actual method itself, do you mean?
Yeah, like if you had...
Unfortunately, it's a bit too early in the PhD to actually give you like a step-by-step guide to how to study phenomena. But, I mean, there are certain standard tenets from phenomenology that you would accept, since, like Ninian Smart's methodological agnosticism. What else? I wasn't expecting to actually have to
and I didn't
lay out
my...
No, it's quite right.
You're throwing at something really, really intriguing, and something that I hope the discipline would actually grow into. So that's why I'm asking it.
So I'm gonna bracket out my skepticism of this for a moment, and ask a more practical, logistical question about how would you go about implementing such a thing? How do you tell other disciplines, okay, stop doing this? And how do you tell people within religious studies, you have to stop doing what you're doing and do it this way?
That's actually the biggie.
It is a big question. I mean, if anybody else has any suggestions for how you might about this, even I will admit that there is no plan for how you demolish other academic departments in order to build up your own. I mean, at the end of the day, I think all of us are left to work with our own rhetoric, basically. I mean, it's a matter of the person who's speaking and how persuasive they can be. So if there is going to be a single methodology behind the department, it's really dependent upon one figure stepping up and being able to knock down all comers. I mean, Ninian Smart was instrumental in the founding of religious studies in Britain. So it's him we have to thank that there is a religious studies department here in Edinburgh at all, as well as around the rest of the country. So it's really a case of, it's not necessarily that there are rules and guidelines for who will or how to develop a department. It's more you're waiting on one person to stand up and knock everyone else down.
I mean, can I just ask? It's not that you're saying that there should be one methodology, right? But that there can be more than one methodology as long as they're all exclusively religious studies, right?
Yes, certainly. Certainly. I mean, sociology is entitled to its own methodologies.
I'm saying even within religious studies.
Oh, yes.
Is there any, like, I don't know enough about this, but is there any actually viable alternative to alternative to phenomenology as being the method of religious studies?
Nothing that I can think of that ever quite, I mean, phenomenology seems sometimes like it was more a kind of dominant orthodoxy only because no one could really have enough numbers to challenge it. There was never a sort of aggressive orthodoxy that some folk like to make it sound like. But, I mean, there was never... I don't think there were many other methods that ever got quite... anthropological methods are obviously very persuasive. There was an attempt at a kind of feminist methodology.
Speaking as the neo-Tylorian, would you not like to set up a competing methodology, though?
It's not a methodology, though, Jonathan. I mean, I've never actually been... anti-phenomenologist. I'm not necessarily totally phenomenologist either, but my concerns, as you would
to go on Russell McCutcheon here are theoretical rather than methodological. So, no, I suppose is the short answer.
So maybe that might be the answer to your question then, that there might not be another dominant methodology within religious studies, but instead what is more important are different theories, and what would unite the department is a particular theory, a theorist rather, expounding one theory and getting everyone to agree with that. I mean, certainly before the comparative religion was originally started off evolutionary trends, which was itself a theory. So that theory was what held sway in what was the study of religion before it was religious studies. So we could see certainly the same happening again here, potentially, under Neo-Tylorianism.
I'm not attempting to, obviously not, the evolutionary aspect. I spend ages talking about how it's bad, but actually trying to explain why, what the motives were behind it. No, so of course not.
Certainly, I don't mean that you promote another evolutionary theory. I think we've learned enough from the past to know that anyone who tries that is going to get knocked down pretty quickly. But I'm just saying that your Neo-Tylorianism in general could be the dominant theory of religious studies.
Well, I mean, I suppose the thing that...
You're being very ingratiating to get more people on your side.
Well, maybe. The only Tylorian thing that keeps popping into my head is the word minimal, which is, you know, Tyler defined religion famously. He described his own definition as minimal. So I'm just thinking that if we do need some kind of unifying factor, but I mean... I was quite excited by what Elizabeth was saying with actually the content of religious studies is quite important, the actual religions themselves. But all what we really bring to the table with religious studies is the attempt to not perfect neutrality, but just attempting to describe what the facts of the religions are, and without being interested in the truth claims. And really it's these kind of things that just have rough, minimal commitment to a social scientific study of religion is all we really need, I think, to set ourselves apart. But just concentrating on the religions.
Okay, maybe let's shift the conversation slightly, because you've mentioned again this concept, the idea of content, and we are defined by our content. Is perhaps the part of the problem of religious studies the content itself? That we are dealing with a very complicated set of phenomena, and trying to put that all under the hubris of one single department is the problem that we're really facing here?
I don't think so. I mean, we obviously in the theory of religion there's a great deal of agonising about the definition of religion and the borders of religion and so on, but outside of the theory of religion, it's not a massive concern. Most people know, roughly speaking, what they mean by religion. They actually do mean certain types of phenomena. I mean, I'm not going to launch into the definition of religion, but it's actually a lot of what I work on. But, I mean, I think that we need to engage with these particular facts that have been described as religious. They are very important. They influence societies a lot. To have a social scientific approach to these, using different disciplines, but having a rough agreement on trying to be social scientific is what we actually need. So religious studies really just needs to be better at selling itself. And to do that, we need a rough agreement of what our aims are and what we think our identity is. But we don't need, I think, anything more than that. We don't need to have one unitary methodology. Sorry.
Okay, jumping onto that one, for those who want to defend the multidisciplinary nature, I mean, you said that people have, like, a kind of implicit definition of religion, and they kind of already know what they're talking about.
Yes.
But, I mean, does that carry across the board to the other departments? I mean, if we are to be multidisciplinary and we're speaking to psychologists and sociologists and anthropologists, is it necessary for all these different disciplines to be working with the same idea of religion? Because if they're not working with the same idea, is there not going to be a bit of cross-purposes going on?
I think that's one of the places where we're sort of one of the fundamental differences, I think, between what you, Jonathan, are saying and what you, Liam, are saying and what I think, is that I don't actually care that there's a self-identity to religious studies. I'm perfectly happy to have little corners of bickering scholars and to have them just sort it out. And And even to, it's harder to, for one individual to try and bring a bunch of disciplines into their own research, but at the same time, it opens them up to more criticism, because if you're trying to take on a psychological perspective and a religious studies perspective as one person and try and put it into one research, you're opening yourself up to the criticism of psychologists and religious studies. And there's more, the more interdisciplinary you are, the more peer review you're going to get.
Yeah, double the criticism with you.
But will that peer review work? Because I'm going to go back to the point I made earlier that they're going to use different rules by which they're going to review you. I mean, does that mean that we're going to need a metadisciplinary set of rules then, in the sense that a set of rules that works across the disciplines for when it comes to this sort of interdisciplinary mingling?
I don't feel that we do. I mean, I think this is anthropology as used by religious studies, psychology as used by religious studies. It's not the discipline as itself. So I don't think we do. I think that, you know, it's a rough, just all we need is a rough consensus among religious scholars. That's all.
But he's saying, to the degree that also other disciplines then are working on the topic of religion, they are going to be bringing a different, and I actually agree with that, but then I don't care about bickering corners, and so it doesn't.
I mean, I would question to the degree to which actually, like, say, sociologists and psychologists actually disagree about religion. They have obviously great disagreements between them, but they tend to, because they are more concerned with psychology and more concerned with sociology, they tend not to actually worry about the definition of religion too much, and they tend to just take a roughly intuitive definition of what religion is. They tend, when they're looking at the psychology of religious belief, for example, they tend to take, you know, oh, let's look at a group of Christians, or let's look at a group of Buddhists, or sociology of religion, they're looking at the influence of the churches, you know, so there's not, I don't think there's a massive disagreement on what religion is based on that, you know, based on their disciplines. I think their disagreements are more based on their primary subject matter, which is about the mind and society, respectively.
Yeah, I sometimes think that every academic discipline has at its core a sacred wound. And that the sacred wound of theology and religious studies, the difference is belief to non-belief. And I don't know if you move too far away from that, which goes back to this very broad defining, looking at religion, explaining it. Liam, you did a great job of naming all the different ways that you can look in on it. You know, that's kind of it. And to spin much more out of that.
Okay, I was just wondering, because you just mentioned the distinction between belief and non-belief, between theology and religious studies. Now, I know Megan isn't a theology student, she's a biblical studies student, but both of those come under the purview of divinity. Now, I'm just going to ask Megan more specifically whether your beliefs come into the kind of work that you do.
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all peer-reviewed. I do statistical analysis of manuscripts and how texts change over time. A person's belief or lack of belief would have absolutely no, or should not have, you know, any influence on that. And if it did, other scholars within the field would pick up on that immediately. And it wouldn't be accepted as good scholarship. So,
but let me ask you, would you ever be employed in a religious studies department as opposed to a theology department?
Definitely. I mean, many of my colleagues go back to the States, and this is, I think, you know, something I've talked to them about. I mean, they'll go back to the States, and they will be hired as religious department scholars teaching religious studies. And I know several who have done that. And I know people who were trained within religion departments in the States and have taught within divinity schools, you know, sort of back and forth. So I don't see the distinction perhaps as sharply as mm-hmm. all of you do. And I understand why there is that difference, but
yeah, I just think that there's something about a meta definition for a reason for a department, which is kind of what this conversation started as. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why there's religious studies as opposed to everything else.
Yeah, but at the same time, I agree with that. I am perfectly aware that people within that discipline don't agree on what that reason is, right, and that they should be able to debate those disagreements.
Of course. Sorry. Well, sort of to expand on what you're saying, I mean, I think that you're quite right, because we don't actually, it's a practical thing. I don't think we actually have much to, if we wander too far away from the, we're attempting to be a roughly neutral humanistic science of religion. If we wander too far away from that, we don't have anything to offer. Because, you know, if we totally collapse the outsider-insider distinction, for example, you know, the insiders can describe their traditions perfectly well. And, you know, you can even have ecumenical things going on, but there's no religious studies if it wandered too far away from its standpoint, wouldn't have anything to offer. So we need to actually try and rally around that standpoint again, I think.
Can I ask you, what do we offer? I mean, this kind of ties back to the previous roundtable of what is the future of religious studies and mm-hmm. what religious studies needs to do in order to maintain its existence. So what do you see religious studies as offering, or what religious studies should be offering?
Well, I mean, I think this is where I have a rough agreement with the phenomenological approach, in that we're just trying to get to grips with the kind of social facts of different religions. What do they believe? What do they practice? How do they regard themselves? But how historically have they interacted with other communities? We're not totally embracing an insider viewpoint, obviously. How do they differ? What are the internal divergences of specific religions? And I think trying to do that is what we have to offer. Sorry, I don't know if I've defined it very well, but
Ethan would like to weigh in.
Since I've been sitting here quietly, I think the issue I take with this issue we're talking about is there is no issue.
Exactly.
In every religious studies course that I've ever taken, and those who know me will know that I've been around. Yeah, I meant it that way. Every religious studies course I've ever taken begins with, we're going to talk about Linnean Smart, or we're going to talk about phenomenology. And it's not so much that we're basing everything we do on this phenomenology methodology. It's sort of a foundation of, this is what religious studies does. We look at religion from different methodological viewpoints. We look at it from different processes of analyzing what it is that religion is, what religious people do, et cetera, et cetera. I think the issue is, there is no issue, because if you take religious studies and say it's only going to be based on phenomenology, then we basically only stuck to one idea. Using phenomenology as a foundation or a basis means that we're allowing ourselves to branch out into all these different multidisciplinary programs, which gives us a future. If we don't do that, if we don't have a phenomenological base, then yes, we can be, let's say, a theology department, which has sort of a bias or an opinion, and there is nothing wrong with that. Or worse, we become a critical religions program, which is like theology, it's just not very clever. So my issue with this is, I don't think there's really much of an issue.
I really feel at this point I should try and defend the critical religions project. It's going to be an awkward moment in my career. I mean, yes, no, to a certain extent, critical religions is in its own way a theology group. I mean, just the other week I heard one of the members of the critical religions group referring to Bethany Hughes's TV program when she was talking about the sacred fire in the city of Rome. And their comment was that nobody psychologically believed that Rome's survival was dependent on the fact that this fire remained alight. Which struck me as a very odd comment to make, because, I mean, if nobody psychologically believed, then at the time I was very confused by what they actually meant by psychologically believed. If nobody believes that, then why would the belief persist? I think part of the problem with the critical religions group is that there is, in a certain respect, it's like it's another version of the religious studies department. There's a lack of self-identity. You look at all the various major scholars in critical religions and you realize they're all arguing slightly different things. And they all have very different understandings of what we mean by critical religions. I mean, I know in my particular case, critical religions means something very different to me than it does to some of the others. So, I mean, in a sense, it's a magnifying lens on the problem of religious studies, that there is, in, to a certain degree, a lack of self-identity and self-knowledge and agreement among departments. I mean, I can completely understand Ethan's point that there is, in a sense, a non-issue here when we're talking about the multidisciplinary nature of religious studies. Unfortunately, if we accepted that, there wouldn't be an hour-long roundtable.
Well, Jonathan, I do. When you were throwing out a couple ideas, what was the first thing I said to you when you had this as a topic?
What topic?
There were a couple ideas for today,
yeah.
And on the street, and when you suggested this one, I said, is there any other way?
Yes, unfortunately it seems that I am the only one who would like there to be another way.
I think to balance that out a little bit, and then I'm going to allow Megan to attack me, but the idea that religious studies is without an identity, I think the issue is that our identity is founded on the phenomenological method, which is where we begin in our youth, and then we grow up. And if we went back to phenomenology, we'd essentially be like a 60-year-old deciding he wants to be 15 all over again. Might not really work. It would just be sort of regressing. I think the fact is that we have this foundation that we've matured from into a broader methodological approach.
Oh, certainly. I mean, what I'm suggesting is not that we go back to Vandeleu and Christensen and we hold to their ideas completely and that anybody who disagrees with them should be kicked out of the department whatsoever. I mean, that's actually very unphenomenological to have this kind of idea that there is a tradition and you hold to that tradition and there is nothing else. But, I mean, it goes back to the point earlier when we were talking about what contributions sociology and anthropology can make. I mean, it would be stupid if any discipline didn't listen to what the other disciplines were saying. But my point is that that doesn't necessarily mean that we can't have our own identity. I mean, perhaps it's a question of appropriation. That when we take on the ideas of someone else, we make sure that we don't just take their idea and we just plonk it down as it is into our department and then just let it sit there and stew for a while. That when we take something on board, that we actually think about how we're taking it on board and how it will relate to the rest of what we're going to do.
But I mean, that is happening. So for example, if you look at the concept of the medical eye, which is in one branch of Foucault's book about the medical gaze, the eye. And then that has sort of become the intelligent eye in art history. I think James Elkins, I think, wrote about the curious eye. Then you have the intelligent eye for works on religion and tourism. There's always the thing of, is there such a thing as a religious tourist eye that is distinct? So I think we are borrowing concepts all the time from other disciplines, but using them or introducing something new to them. So I think that's already there.
Yeah, and I do think the blending, and back to actually what you said earlier, Megan, I think if we went back a couple hundred years, we would have a very different approach to textual studies and things like that. I do think that we're talking something that the whole academy has moved in a direction of being more self-critical.
In that case, maybe the question now is that can religious studies be biasless? Or do we have to accept some form of bias? I don't know what shape that bias would take. Can religious studies, is that the unattainable goal to be neutral, that religious studies shouldn't really be looking for? Is there a bias that
we should... And assuming that you're the only department that wants to do that.
No, okay. Certainly. I mean, like, I'm speaking in generalities at the moment, that religious studies as a whole... Is there a bias to it, and should we be self-aware of our own bias and accept that bias?
Also, in the idea that religious studies, if there's a bias in religious studies, it's a little different if there's a bias in like a history department or a sociological department. Well, and the fact that what we're studying is extremely prevalent to people in a very specific, private way. So if we're studying Christianity or Islam, and we have a bias in the way we're studying it, it's a little different than if we're just studying the history of it. And of course, there are people like, I think it was Lewis, and you can tell me if I'm incorrect on that, somebody who studies Islam, but basically, I think it's Bernard Lewis, said that, you know, Islam is sort of dangerous, et cetera, et cetera. And Samuel P. Huntington at Harvard took that on a little bit in describing what American identity is, and it's not Islamic, and it's not anything other than basically white Christian.
I think bias can be just as harmful in history, if not more, I think, because with religious studies, at least there is a religious... with history, I think the academic study of history is more accessible to people than the academic study of religion is to people who are not studying religion. So, for example, if in the university, you're studying as history, there is a textbook, there is some kind of concept of history. And so in India, there's massive controversies about people just, you know, rewriting history textbooks
history,
with a particular bias, the Hindu right-wing bias. And so I think the danger is there pretty much throughout. I'd say possibly in religion it's less because if, for example, at this round table, we were to adopt X framework and say, according to X framework, Y is not a religion, it wouldn't actually affect the practitioners of that religion, because it's the reason we're coming up with these definitions, they're not meant to be operational, but in the realm of theory. So I think bias is actually a less
important. So you're saying that, like, historiography, the way that the story gets told, because it's presented as, are people accepted more as fact than a religious studies?
Well, no, I think that because religious studies is possibly a newer discipline than history, I guess, and also because so much of what we're doing is in the realm of theory. It's not operational. We're not actually going to be giving the findings of this meeting or of other meetings to governments and saying and asking them to use this to decide compensation to religious group. Mm. But history is sort of in that sense operational, or at least I think so. I know that.
I think that's fair. I mean, history, religious studies has potentially a lot to say and could be very influential, but it's largely ignored and it's largely its own fault. History is very influential and undeniably so. And I'm not disagreeing with you at all there. And yes, historical bias can be.
Oh my goodness, we're writing ourselves into inconsequence, which was gets back to Jonathan's original question.
But this is also the thing, is you get all this kind of supposedly critical theory that's saying, oh, we should never try to be unbiased, and all this nonsense in my eyes. And that trying to be not caring, you can of course never be completely unbiased. I perfectly agree with that. But the danger of not recognising or not attempting to overcome biases is actually incredibly dangerous. And I think we need to remember that, sorry.
But it's not a commitment to being biased. Like, there's a difference. I mean, it's not like there's an author. But, I mean, with the entire concept of authorship, which is what is so important in religious studies, who is the theorist?
Yes.
If you accept that that is at all an important question, then immediately the question of bias becomes... I mean, the most important, or one of the really important questions. If you, what I'm saying basically is, if it's at all important that X wrote this instead of Y, then the biases of X become really significant.
I mean, okay. And I think one of the things separating religious studies from history of religions is that we tend to be dealing with living communities, and that means that we potentially could write something that could upset the communities we're talking about. And, you know, that's why we need to be careful. I mean, I'm not saying I don't want religious studies to be dictated by the insiders, but I also want it to be, as Graham Harvey talks about, you know, when you go in and actually, like an anthropologist or an ethnographer, go and study a community, you are... You are getting your information from them because they've allowed you to come in, so you need to be respectful of the community.
Of course, respect is one thing, but I mean, would it actually make it? I've never done ethnography,
okay.
So I don't know. But if, for example, I know, I think this is Stringer, who in God and Grant, he was talking about this fieldwork that he did, and after sort of ages of fieldwork, he went to the constituency where he did the fieldwork and said, these are my findings, and they all said, well, that's totally wrong. And that provoked him to write another sort of work on this.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that they might have been annoyed about the fact that it was wrong, but it didn't cause them to lose it's not going to deny them. I mean, if you might deny them the religion, but that doesn't mean that they'll embrace that denial and say, now we're religionless.
No.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'll just weigh in here with a little bit of a feminist perspective that if groups don't get written and get presented, that often that becomes all that's remembered. So I do think that even missing the mark has great impact.
I was wondering if, Megan, you've experienced any of this, because you're dealing with text crits and you're dealing with texts that are very old.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this idea of authorship and which pieces of information are relevant surely applies a lot to even biblical studies. I mean, Bethany Hughes' TV series recently was talking about the importance of women in the rise of early Christianity and how they've been written out of the church. So, I mean, perhaps as scholars we do have a lot of responsibility, even as even in a historical context, that what we write has... Maybe it's not going to affect now because the people who are being missed out are alive and well enough to say, you're missing me out. But in 50 years' time, those people might be dead and buried and completely forgotten. So maybe we do have to be careful, even in a history of religions, if that's all we're going to do, if all we're going to do is catalogue everything and anything that's out there, that even that has to be done very carefully.
I think you originally asked a question. I was just trying, or did you answer
it? Yeah, I mean, I think I might have answered it myself, but I mean, if you've got... Damn. I wasn't supposed to.
It might be a feminist challenge.
Yeah. No.
Let me ask the woman the question and answer it for you, sweetie.
For the listeners, his ears have just turned red.
Thanks, Ethan. That's a helpful contribution, considering you're not meant to be saying anything.
I know. I do what I can.
Okay. So let me put it another way. Some of the problems that Kritika has highlighted, are you finding that yourself in your own work at all, that certain people are being left out?
You mean left out now as in scholars now, or I'm trying to figure out exactly what question you're asking.
Like, I mean, in terms of the historical figures themselves,
yeah.
I mean...
Are certain historical figures being left out?
Yes.
Definitely. I mean, it depends on the data that we have. So, for instance, I work specifically with early Christianity. So, how the text changed specifically within the first, few hundred years, and so I have very little data to work with. And of course, there are communities that we know could not have been represented because we know that there were many of them, and we just don't have text from them. So, the text that I'm working with right now, there's really only one witness to the early text of the Pauline epistles. So it's a completely different issue, I think, for me. But if you talk to someone who is maybe in ecclesiastical history, who's dealing with hagiographies, whatever, those are some of the issues that they would come up against. But again, this is a historical question. So I find it interesting because, just kind of coming back to my earlier point when you were talking about theology, coming from a biased point of view, I think that it's important for those who are in disciplines outside of religious studies that they be understood properly. because I feel like that doesn't always happen, especially when you're working with people who are supposedly insiders. Because you're sort of assuming, for instance, that the entire school of divinity or whatever, that they all have religious convictions, when that's definitely not true. So I see that, at least between divinity and religious studies, if you have two separate departments, I can see that it would be very helpful to have a dialogue between those two departments, I think, for both sides. But, and that's a larger point we could talk about another time. So.
Well, actually, no, because I'd like to draw that out a bit more, because, for instance, you're uncovering potentially new texts or giving new translations to these people, and these are texts which these people will find important, the believers will find important. So even though that you yourself are coming from, when you're doing this work, you're doing so from a non-biased or a non-religious point of view, the results of the work that you are doing are going to have an effect upon those people.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the results, of course. But, yeah, I mean, we've seen this before, especially with text criticism. It can be either helpful to certain communities. Certain religious communities just don't care about it. And others, it upsets them quite a bit. And so, we have to be aware of what you would call, I guess, the insiders, how they would react to that information. But that's not necessarily our main concern. We have to be aware of it, but we're also just doing the work in order to, come to some sort of conclusion that we can all agree on, at least somewhat. It depends, too, on your area. I mean, it's a little bit easier for me to point to numbers and say, these manuscripts agree a certain percentage, plus or minus, you know, a few percentage points. But it might be a bit more difficult for someone who is trying to talk from a feminist point of view, for instance, doing a feminist critique of a New Testament text. But again, because it's religion, it's a very emotional issue, so people, you know, we expect them to bring up.
But other disciplines' work affects people's religious issues also. I mean, it would be hard to go to a evolutionary biologist and say, tone it down, you know, because this offends someone's religious belief, or to physics or any of the, and so, and I feel like the same applies to religious studies in a certain sense. And maybe this takes us to the critics versus caretakers issue, but
that, and it also takes us back to the previous roundtable about should we trust social scientists, because you've just mentioned evolutionary theory, which is something of the natural sciences, and if we inhabit the realm of social science, are we the same kind of science as the natural science, or is the social science a different beast entirely that shouldn't be constrained by the findings of natural science?
Well, I mean, it shouldn't contradict the natural science.
Can you justify that?
I mean, we shouldn't. I would be surprised if this is just my position, but it is my position. It would be very unsettling to me to see a social scientist write something that contradicted the consensus findings of the natural sciences. I don't see why that would happen. I don't see how that is all relevant to...
Well, certainly from a phenomenological perspective, when you're trying to... you have to predicate every phrase with that, unfortunately. From that perspective, when you say, when you're talking about what the believers think, particularly if you want to demonize this whole conversation about evolution, you then set it up against creationists. When you're talking about creationists, you have to be fair to the creationists, and you have to understand what it means for them to understand the world to be created in 6 days. So you are naturally going to say things that will end up contradicting what the natural sciences say.
But you're not contradicting it in the sense that you're saying the natural scientists are false, that what their findings are false. You're describing the beliefs of the creationists.
It seems like a whole other animal altogether. I mean, the debate between creationists and natural scientists, and et cetera, et cetera. But I think you mentioned earlier that, you know, a sort of scientific approach, let's say there's a natural science program and they've come to the conclusion that the world is not 6,000 years old and it's rather 4.3 billion, that might offend a religious person. Which is possibly true, or true. I mean, it would be true, I'd imagine.
Well, I think that's...
But at the same time, just to jump on top of you there for a second, but at the same time, that is not necessarily the same thing as if a religious studies research project came out and said, we've done a religious studies, based in a religious studies department, religious studies test, and found that James Usher's dating is wrong.
But religious studies doesn't have the capabilities to make that statement.
Therefore, can it rely on the natural sciences?
But
I mean,
that wasn't my point. My point was that since we're talking about bias and potential bias, the goal of academia broadly, regardless of the discipline, is a sort of asymptotic approach towards lack of bias. In other words, you're moving towards it, but never quite getting there. That's true across academia broadly, whether you're talking about religious studies or the social sciences or the natural sciences. What I'm saying is that if the argument is that religious studies needs to be careful because it might offend people, that's also true in natural sciences and in other fields. And so would you also apply that to them? You wouldn't say, don't do evolutionary biology, don't do astronomy because it might insult somebody's religious sensibilities. I think that applies just as well to religious studies, that and religious studies people do it all the time. They religious studies people say and should say, this view that the insiders hold is not supported by the historical record, or is not supported by the textual record, and we do that all the time. And it's not a question of whether the practitioners themselves are going to find dispute with that.
I think, Liam, because this was sort of, you were making this point earlier, right?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to put a point of clarification because I kind of may have sparked this one off. Because I don't mean, that's why I said that, you know, I don't want religious studies research to be dictated by the insiders. I'm not saying that you can't disagree with the insiders, or that you say anything which could potentially offend them, because obviously people can be offended by almost anything potentially. It's rather that, as Ethan was saying, it's not so much in the nature of our discipline to tackle these things, but also, you know, you're just not misrepresenting the people under study. You're just trying to get to grips with their views from their perspective, and that is all that I meant, really. That would be
working towards this non-bias.
Indeed, and actually, I think they've argued theoretically that the Neo-Tylorian position is very much that you have to be rooted in a rough understanding of the natural sciences, and that's where the value of religious studies comes in.
Probably going to have to disagree with the both of you on this one. From my perspective, and whether I can justify this phenomenologically or not, I'm not entirely sure. But I would say that the natural sciences are as much an object of study for the social sciences as religious views. So in that respect, as far as I'm concerned, that means we shouldn't really be incorporating the natural sciences into our theoretical basis. I mean, I can't remember who was talking about it earlier, but somebody was talking about the new atheists and using evolution. It's as much a piece of rhetoric that you would find in a religious discourse as you would find
in those contexts when they do it badly, though.
Yes.
And but is it our place to say that they're doing it badly? This is an interesting point.
Yeah.
Because we're in this awkward position, I think, when it comes to the natural sciences. Because sometimes you get this with theologians who wish to engage in the religious studies discourse, is that you have to be careful how you respond to them, because you can't be sure whether they're trying to speak to you as a fellow religious studies scholar, or if it's a believer who is reacting to your theory or your study or whatever in a bad way. And this is part of the reason why I think multidisciplinarity is a slight problem, because there's no real proper bridges between different disciplines on how the two separate disciplines can talk to one another. And because of that, you're going to get mistranslations and miscommunications. So,
and you work that out over time.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mean to sound harsh, but I mean, the new atheist is kind of a bad example, because they are an example of scientism rather
right.
than science. You know, Dawkins may be a gifted scientist when it comes to evolutionary biology, but everything, almost every rhetorical point that he writes wouldn't be embraced necessarily by science. And I feel we are a human science, and he doesn't understand the nature of the phenomena under study, and so that's not scientific. I only advocate that we are roughly rooted in a world of natural science, we're not radically embracing it. And I do agree that obviously natural science can be a study for social science. There is actually an entire discipline called science and society, or science studies, which is social science of science, if you like. But I only a loose understanding, just so we can differentiate the many different worldviews we have to negotiate in religious studies, and we can never be unsituated. So, situated in a loosely natural scientific universe isn't a problem. There's a problem if you're embracing radical scientism and saying that, you know, the Christian Abrahamic worldview is nonsense because it clashes with the natural worldview. That's a problem. But, you know, roughly understanding, okay, these people believe in a god, and it's roughly super or extra natural because it's something else. Sorry.
In reference to that, I mean, it could be also that when we do work in religious studies, and this also pertains to the earlier discussion we had about respecting the people that we are studying, I think it's important that whatever studies we do in this department is done in good faith. I think that's always a really good test, whether it's done in good faith. And that, again, can also be a grounds for which you can critique other theories, mm-hmm. which, I mean, so I think that...
What do you mean good faith, if you don't
mind? I mean, with a certain amount of, I guess, respect to the sort of well-meaningness... Mm. To the not necessarily you're doing good or some benevolent, like it's not some benevolent act.
Not misrepresenting them, is that roughly what you mean? No.
Sorry, just before anyone else, I mean, if Kritika would like to finish off that statement, if she's got anything more to say, I was just going to actually cut off the discussion there, partly because we have reached our time limit, but also we're about to broach upon the next roundtable, which will be the question of critics and caretakers, whether we should be taking care of religion or whether we should be critical of religion. So,
it's almost like I'd like I was to... given a prompt to say that.
She wasn't, by the way.
But it makes you want to come back and hear the next one.
That's my lie. So, I would like to thank the panel of Elizabeth, Liam, Megan, Kevin, Kritika, and Ethan, who wasn't supposed to speak at all. This has been the Religious Studies Project trying to answer the question, should religious studies be multidisciplinary? Thank you for listening.
You're welcome.